Welcome in. It's another week of How to Survive in the City. I am your host, Justin B. Love, here to guide you through what we call life in the urban jungle, in this concrete jungle we call home, that is New York City. And boy, this is really the first week where it's really felt like spring right out of the gate. I know Monday just felt amazing. I was actually out of the city over the weekend, spent some time upstate, got a little rest and relaxation. Everyone should take a break, but everyone should get out of the city and escape, especially right before the seasonal apartment market really starts to take off. And what does that mean? My coworker is looking for an apartment right now, and she's looking all over in a story. She's getting like a 2-month jump. And why is that? Just for all of you newbies out there who don't know, summer is the time when your landlords, they try to screw you up. And why is that? It's because they're selfish and they're money hungry. No, seriously, it's because more people are looking at this time and more, you know, you have the interns that are coming in, the seasonal housing that's coming in. And if you don't have your apartment ready by now, then you're going to be paying higher rent for the rest of the year. So just keep that in mind when you start looking for an apartment right now. And then, because you're going to get stuck in a terrible one, and it's going to be one where your landlord's going to, well, your super's going to be live-in super. He's going to live below you or on the first floor. He's not going to speak English. And then by the time, when you have to ask him any questions, but if it's 5:05, he's not going to talk to you anymore, and you're going to have to deal with him at 8 o'clock the next day. This is really what's going to happen to you. You're going to get stuck in a terrible apartment. How do I know? Because that's what happened to me the first time that I moved to the city. I was not prepared, and I just signed the lease on the first thing that I found. We're getting into spring, starting to warm up, getting into summer. You guys should be on the lookout, because just like de Blasio's keeping cars out of Central Park and screwing up everyone there, your super and your landlord's going to screw you over on your apartment building. And with that, we got a great guest coming up right after this. His name is Jason Green, and he is a, quote, modern dad. I don't really know what modern dads are. But I bet a modern dad knows how to find a good apartment, especially when he has 4 kids.
Hi, this is Mike Coscarelli from Anxiety Now.
And Andrea Allen from the Hot Mess Comedy Hour.
We just launched the brand new OG Podcast Network and wanted to let you know that you can hear ours and other great shows by going to ogpodcastnetwork.com.
Also, be sure to follow the network on social media to keep up to date with new shows, videos, and live events.
That's at OG Podcasts on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
Or you can subscribe to your favorite OG podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
My special guest on How to Survive in the City this week is a man by the name of Jason Green. He is a husband and a father, and you know, people generally don't have, or at least people our age, don't have kids when they're living in New York City. We had Carol Markowitz on a couple of episodes ago talking about it, and now we have Jason, and he has you can check out his blog at onegooddad.com. Jason, thanks so much for joining me via Skype today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about living in New York.
And you're actually the first person that we've actually done remote. I usually have people come in, but you have to watch your children. So I said no, you can do it over Skype.
Yeah, and let's hope they don't barge in here, which they could do at any moment.
No, and if they barge in, the better. I won't be like those TV, like that guy on television when his kid interrupted the interview. They can jump on and talk if they want.
they might do that.
All right, so you actually have a pretty interesting perspective of when you moved to New York. So, because you were already married when you moved, right?
Right. We had been married just for a few months, and it was our plan all along to move to New York. I wanted to be an actor, and my wife wanted to go to law school. And so my job was finishing up, and we hadn't had we didn't have an apartment yet. And my wife was starting school in a couple of days. And so she actually came out and she stayed in a hostel in the city for a couple of weeks and looked for an apartment while I was finishing up my job. I was a caseworker in Columbus, Ohio.
Okay. So you guys are from Ohio?
We are. Yeah. We're, we're, We're Buckeyes.
So a caseworker, like for, like a law firm?
Yeah, I was a caseworker. I was working for Job and Family Services in Ohio. I was help low income families get with assistance in finding job placements.
Oh, okay. So like a social worker.
Right. Yeah, social worker.
Okay, and so you went but you've always wanted to be an actor. Then that's what brought you to New York City.
Right. So I always wanted to be an actor. That was my dream since I was a child. And so my wife, she called me up and she said, I found a place in Queens. And I was like, I don't want to live in Queens. I want to live in Manhattan. That's where all the fun is. And she's like, well, yeah.
Have you seen the rent prices in Manhattan?
Right. Right. So we came out for a weekend and looked for places. And there was some places that were in our budget range that I could touch, both sides of the wall, both walls of this by stretching out. And that would have been our master bedroom. And so
at least it was a bedroom
and
not at least it was a bedroom and not a studio.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It probably was a studio at one time.
But she found a place in Queens.
She found a place in Queens in Astoria. And it turned out my job finished up and she was sleeping in a sleeping bag on the floor for a week when I came in, and I came up with the U-Haul, drove the U-Haul, over the bridges into Queens and unloaded, and we started asking everyone around, our neighbors and everyone, and everyone said that we are very lucky to be living in Astoria, and everyone mentioned about the many great restaurants that are in Astoria.
Now, when did you move? Like, what year is this? Like, has Astoria already gentrified, or is it?
It was on. I think we started it.
the pioneers.
Yeah. So I was just starting to be gentrified, I think, when we came in. I think the secret was out of the bag when we started coming in about what a great neighborhood Astoria is.
Yeah, I have one friend. She's in Astoria, and then another who's in Astoria, but moving to Long Island City. So that's a. But anyways, both great areas with a lot of food, from what I hear. But you had, when you guys you probably didn't realize it, but you had a step up on most people when they moved to New York. Because you already had a built-in roommate and someone that you trust in.
Right, yeah. So we had that. So even though we'd only been living together for a few months because we just got married, but we were still. So we had to go through all that first year of marriage difficulties and fights and getting to know each other while getting to know a city where we didn't know anybody. We had no friends, no family.
God, you learn a lot about yourself and your spouse real quick, I bet.
We did. And it was very hard to find a job. It was very hard to find employment. This was not long after 9/11. So it was a very hard time for finding jobs. I mean, it was a hard time for everybody, but as far as
well,
finding a job to pay rent, pay bills.
So you're trying to find a day job, and on top of that, you're trying to be an actor. So, did you ever land a gig or anything?
I did some plays, but nothing that I would ever walk down the street and say, "Hey, you're on this show I just saw."
a lot of off Broadway stuff.
Right, off Broadways, some short films. And a whole lot of student films.
Hey, look, I mean, Lena Dunham, whatever anyone thinks about her, got her start from a YouTube comedy thing. And the next thing you know, she's doing Girls on HBO. But so while you're trying to chase it, what are some of the jobs you have while you're trying to pay rent and be an actor when your wife is in law school?
Oh yeah. Well, so I worked at like Banana Republic. I worked at Gap, and I worked at Bally's Fitness, which was that was horrible.
Hey, look, there's nothing. My first job in the city was also at a gym before I got my gig at the radio station. So nothing wrong with working at a gym.
No. I worked in the HR at the gym, and I was in this like three floors into the basement in a room you know, doing paperwork all day for 8 hours.
Now, were you HR like at the retail stores, or were you walking the floor selling people polos and button downs?
No, I handled employees.
Okay. So that's a little better than just the actor that comes up and they're working at the coffee shop or they're bartending or. Sure.
Until I lost that job, and then they went on a hiring freeze, and so I knew my days are numbered when my job was to train the new employees, and they had a hiring freeze. So then I got a job at Barnes & Noble, and I really enjoyed working at Barnes & Noble, and I love reading and talking about books, so I had a lot of fun.
The one at Union Square?
It was on 86. It was 86th Street in Lexington. It's closed now.
Oh.
It's a Petco now, I think, or something like that. But it was funny. It was one of the smaller Barnes and Noble. And so there was a lot of famous people that would come in, and I would help famous people buy books and give them suggestions. And
people who have never even actually bought a book before.
Yeah.
Or if they have, someone else has just done it for them. So.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, it was a lot of fun. Like I walked Tom Brokaw around the store one day and I suggested books to Tom Brokaw, which was a lot of fun.
Did he ever use one of those books in one of his many pieces that he's done for NBC?
Yeah. I wondered if it's in the books that... Yeah, which is funny that he said he was going on a trip and he wanted so I gave him like 6 or 7 books to go on the trip, and he gave me the impression that he's going to read all 6 or 7 of them in the next couple of weeks.
You never know. He's a very smart man. He probably read them all in a day.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Probably, yes. But he had that really deep voice when he was just talking to me about books. I thought it would be like a put-on voice, but no, that was his real voice.
So you're going around, you've worked at a gym, you've worked at retail, and you're at Barnes & Noble. And then your wife got pregnant. Now, were you guys planning on having children while you were here, or did that just something that just kind of happened?
No, it was between my wife's second and third year of law school. And everyone says if you're going to have a kid, you should have it between your second and third year of law school, because once you start your law career, it's hard to have children. And so we wanted to. It wasn't like we weren't trying, but we were not trying. So
I get it.
Yeah. So I was working during the day and then auditioning and networking at night. And then and then we had tickets to go see Letterman the one night. And she tells me, she's like, I just got home from, being out late at night. And she tells me we're going to have a baby. And I was like, what? And then we went to see Letterman, and I think we just sat there in the audience the whole time, just staring straight, not laughing, not cheering, nothing, just staring straight.
Nothing was funny after that.
Nothing. We were just in complete daze.
Now, so like, what was your reaction? I mean, obviously happy, because now you had 3 more kids after that. Were you worried, how to provide, maybe even have to find a new apartment?
Yeah, well, we knew we were going to have to find a new apartment because our apartment was very small and that we were in. And so we knew that someday we were going to have an apartment. But in New York, you see some families with 2 kids, 3 kids in very small spaces, coming out. And you're thinking, how do they all fit in there? But it happened. So, we saw that, and it's like, well, some people make it work. And so if we're going to have to make it work, we'll figure out ways to make it work. And so, but I've always been maybe overconfident that things are going to turn out okay.
You're an optimist.
So I'm an optimist, and even though we have a baby, then my wife's career is uncertain, and I wanted to be an actor, and there wasn't anything really going my way at the time. But and still in my life, it's all going to work out. Something's going to happen. Our luck will be fine. We have each other, and we'll take on whatever. Whatever comes our way, we'll be all right.
If for people who maybe have already checked out the blog, onegooddad.com, and for those who haven't, if you go there, you find out that Jason is this new stay-at-home dad, which has kind of come up on the rise in the new, the modern dad era?
Yeah.
I don't really know. But when did you realize, was it after the birth of your first child, or like, was it the second one? When did you realize, hey, look, my wife's going to be a lawyer, I need to stay home?
Well, yeah. So I continued to work at a Barnes. I was at Barnes & Noble still. And my wife, we had the baby during the summer. And then she started school in the fall. And I would work in the evenings and she'd go to school in the daytime. And we would pass off our baby on the subway platform at Lexington Avenue. I would step off the train. I would step off on one side and she would step off the train. She would hand me our son, Dan, and she would get back on one side, and I'd go on the other. I'd go home, and she would go home, and I would go to work. We were like, hi, goodbye.
I guess it's no difference than like when my mom would like trade me off with my grandparents in a mall parking lot. It's just a little it's just a little different because it's a subway platform.
It's subway, it's loud, there's rats running around, and
that's true. There's no rat inside the car if you're
right,
if you're being dropped off.
So it was what it was, then we off went our separate ways. Then late at night we get back together, and then so we did that for until she was done with law school. And and then she got a job, and it was the plan was so well. It just made sense that I would stay home. I had been there with the baby in the mornings anyway, and then I was always very active during the nights, and every time I was home, I absolutely loved being a dad. And so we just decided that I would stay home since she had the promising career and my acting career wasn't really happening. It just made more sense that I would stay home. And then someday when the kid, we were just planning on one at the time, when the kid was a little bit older, that I would, give the acting and the old college try one more time.
Now, you're from Ohio. I'm from Alabama. So I guess we had similar parents. I wouldn't call my dad my dad would cry in front of me if he had to cry. He didn't cry much. He cried at a funeral. I'd assume we have like traditional parents, but what was it like, or was it hard for you to have to like take a step back and be like, okay, my wife's going to provide for the family and I'm going to provide the stay at home, care role?
Well, the men that I grew up around, my dad, uncles, grandparents, all those types, all those men that I, had in my Rolodex of what a man is, were all I call them the armchair dads. They sit in the chair, and while they wait for their drinks and their food, and the women, the wives, the moms, they do all the work around the house. And so that was sort of but seeing that, I never wanted to be that. I always wanted to be the hands-on dad. But I'm also a realist, and it just to know that since I didn't really have a career going for me, it would be very selfish and unwise if I would have told my wife, I'm going to go to work and I think you should find a career that, meets, that will keep you at home more often. And that would have been very selfish and unwise since, she had the opportunity to have a great career.
Yeah, but I think, because you moved here to be an actor, a lot of people who moved to New York, they're so passionate about their dream. I'm not questioning your passion, but they're like, no, honey, you can work, definitely work, go you, but I'm still going to go out there and audition and beat the street and try to figure something out. But did that cross your mind that maybe you could do both?
Well, it did cross my mind that, if I could do both, that would be great. But then the realism of having this little child that needs you and I did not want, I was so in love with being a dad and being a father, and I didn't want somebody else taking care of my kid when I could have still chosen to be an actor and beat the streets and doing the networking parties late at night. But it would have been having to rely on somebody else to be with my son who, if I had my choice of being anywhere else in the world, it would have been right there with him. So it was, do I be an actor or do I wanted more than anything else in the world was to, be an actor and be on the stage and command audiences' attention. But then I had this new role of being a daddy, and that seems to eclipse anything that I've ever wanted to be in my whole life. And I still did have that dream of someday, like, you know what, someday maybe I will be an actor. And then my second daughter came along, my daughter came along, my second child. We are going to try. We are going to get babysitters now and then. And I'll go to auditions. And I had my son. He was a 2 at the time. And I took him to an audition with me. And I went in, and like I really wanted this part. It was like this, you know, gruesome part. It was about this heroin addict, and which are all, if you're an actor, heroin addicts are a lot of, they're interesting to play. you get to go through a lot of, you know,
some deep dark places.
Right. And those are the type of characters that I've always played, were these deep, dark sort of, these dark characters. And so I really wanted this part. So I get in there and I get the side, the portion of the script, and like every other word is a swear word. And I got my 2-year-old sitting on the floor, you know, coloring in a coloring book right next to me. I can't show him this side of me right now. And so I just told him, I'm sorry, I can't do this right now. And I walked out, but I wasn't like sad or upset or discouraged or depressed. It was like, well, this is my choice now. That this is who I am. I'm a dad above anything else. And so a lot of times I think about what this news, like, what does it mean to be a man in these modern times, this modern manhood? What does that look like now? And I think, and I usually tell people, a modern man is someone who steps up, does the right thing for other people, that puts others before himself. And so I think I sort of, in my own terms, manned up by putting my son and my family over my own needs.
Yeah, I would definitely say so. That's a big dream to, I don't want to say to walk away from, at least for the time being, you know, because it's something you wanted your whole life.
Right.
But then you found out that being a dad could be just as rewarding.
Right, even more so, and that's sort of how my blog came about. It's actually I started my blog thinking that I was going to go back into acting, and then all of my stories were about taking my kids to different places in New York City, and that's why my first title was, you know, the name for my blog was my name. It was The Jason Green, because I thought I was going to be, you know, an actor or whatever, you know, some famous actor when I started my page. And then I eventually changed it to One Good Dad. But it started out as The Jason Green because I wanted to tell all these stories about, you know, here I am auditioning, and I'm going to be in this play, and I'm going to be in this, you can find me here. And but then I was only telling stories about raising kids in New York City. And then somebody, I went to a meetup group for NYC Dads Group, and I was talking to someone there, one of the co-founders, Matt Schneider, one of the co-founders, and he's like, "Oh, you're a dad blogger." I had no idea dad bloggers was a thing. I didn't even know what a blog was. I had never read a blog before, and I was like, "Oh." And then I looked into it. I'm like, "Oh yeah, I guess I am a dad blogger." And I started reading all these other dad blogs and started making friends with other online dads, and it's been a whole other career that arose just out of being a dad and telling my stories.
Well, yeah, I was looking at a piece you had up today. Well, I guess I don't know if it came out today, but when you took your 2-year-old to the Guggenheim. Because, yeah. I mean, I get bored in museums. So like, that kind of brings, like, what do you do during the day, or what do you do with your kids in the city besides, like, take them to a park?
Right. Well, my favorite thing to do in the city is take my kids to museums. Like, and the Guggenheim is a great museum to take to the kid, take a toddler to, because it has that long ramp, that spiraling ramp.
Yeah, no.
and my daughter will just run up and down that ramp. Like, it annoys all the art lovers out there. But some of the snootier art people.
You know,
that come in,
they can get over it, because your 2-year-old daughter, she'll remember that forever. that you let her run up and down the Guggenheim ramp.
Yes. Right. Yeah. And so it's things like that. Like I take them to and, you know, taking all the other, you know, having, you know, raising my kids in New York City. I actually love raising my kids here because the whole world is right outside their doorstep and museums bring the whole world to them. And that's one of my favorite things about raising kids here is taking them to museums that we have so much cultural richness here.
So you see this as like a benefit because myself, I would think this is just such a daunting challenge, almost impossible to like because there's just so many other pressure outside pressures on the city on just a single person who lives here. But you have four kids, and what are their what are the age ranges? You have a 2 year old and.
Sure, I have a 2 year old, a 6 year old, 11 year old, and 13 year old.
So that's a wide gap right there.
It is.
To keep them all entertained. Are you not scared, especially now you have a teenager? Does that not? The city terrifies me, even though I know it's safe. I'm 27, and I still get scared sometimes.
Yeah, it is scary, but it's like, but and I guess you too. We weren't raised here. And like, you know, my son, he was sort of raised into just being street smart in a way that he knows how to, there's a crazy person on the subway. I'm going to, you know,
get in the next car.
I'm going to not make eye contact, but I'm going to watch him. And, you know, it's, you know, I'm not going to stare at him. I'm going to act like he's not here, but I'm going to pay attention to what he's doing. And, you know, your kids here are raised, you know, if you see something, say something. So they're, you know, it's odd, you know, you're aware.
That's true. Something you don't really worry about when you live in the suburbs or in a different state.
Right. Yeah. Like my son goes, he takes the subway to school. And I was a nervous wreck at first. And I made him like text me when he got on the on the subway, when he got off the subway, when he got to school.
I was about to ask you when you let him ride the subway.
Yeah, like last year, I let him ride the subway by himself.
So when he was 12.
Right. Yeah, so you know, we made sure he had to, he knew how to get to school and all that. And he's fine. Like, yeah, all right, well, I got it.
You're always more nervous than your children are.
Yeah, like typical city kid. Like the kids that are raised in the city, they are fearless here. I mean, they're so confident.
But are there any other particular challenges especially when you're raising kids in the city? I mean, obviously just the having them go out in the city alone, but I guess I always I could always just go out and ride my bike whenever I wanted, you know, because our streets weren't that busy.
Right. Yeah. That seems like that, you can't just, you know, it's like you have to give and you have to take. I mean, it's sort of, you know, there's good and the bad, and the bad is that they can't just ride bikes around town, or like I used to do it. I was in Ohio and I'd get on my bike and ride to my friend's house, you know, 6 or 7 blocks away. That's hard. Like my son's old enough now that he can call up his friend and say, let's go meet in the park to play soccer. And there are some great parks around the city that the kids can go to and play. Of course, I'm not going to let my 6-year-old do that. And so, you know, there's a lot of great little playgrounds that can meet those needs of letting kids just go out by themselves. So I guess it does take some independence away when they just can't go off to their friend's house. But again, it's like there's good and bad. That's the bad part. The good part is there is so much to do. There's never a reason for a kid to say I'm bored.
That's true. It's hard to be bored in this city. But that could also be a problem. I mean, I don't have children, but that could also, you know, you don't want them getting involved in things that they shouldn't get involved with. So do you talk to them? Are you, like, my parents never really talked to me about drugs other than don't do it, and there was the DARE program.
Right.
Do you have, like, more open conversations with your children about drugs and what not to do?
Yeah, I think my wife and I, we've felt that all these difficult conversations will be a lot easier later on if you're having them on smaller scales when they're young. And so we've been talking about drugs, about sex, about even gender equality with our kids since they were, you know, before they go to school. And so, I mean, on smaller scales when they're younger, and then it didn't, as they get older, the conversations, you know, has more knowledge to it. So there was never a moment when we were talking about sex, our drugs, our gender issues, that there was nothing out of the blue, or nothing. It was never a hard conversation. It was just building on a conversations that we've been having.
We touched about a little bit modern dad versus what we had, like the traditional dad. What would you say a modern dad is? And like what? And I mean, obviously you are one. So what separates you from your father, or from my dad, you know, from that older generation?
Well, I think first is just changing with the times, right? There's so much going on in the world and right now, and the world is changing, and you have to be able to change with it, or you're going to be, it's going to pass you by. And so you have to understand your. So to be a modern dad is to be or a modern man is to, again, like putting others above your own self-interest, even if you disagree with them, even if you don't like what's happening. That sometimes if things are not going the way that you think they should go, or you go, you have to put other people's feelings and issues ahead of your own in a way. And to, you just want, for to help society move along, that you have to be not a detractor, but just be helping, help things be more positive, help things in a positive way, push things along in a positive way. And I think that's my job as a modern dad, as a modern man, to just help. If there's going to be a good future for my kids, it's trying to be more positive for them and try to make a world that's more accepting and more caring.
Yeah, maybe not be the dad that when your daughter goes on the prom date, a gun in the picture.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, I wrote something a few years ago about how I hate those shirts that say, like, you know, some dad's guy, this is, I know how to clean a gun and all these things, and here's the rules for dating my daughter. And like, I hate those shirts that I see, like, these are the rules for dating my daughter. And
I get there probably should be rules for when you, but maybe don't wear it on the shirt, and definitely don't, like, the jokes about having dads with guns have not aged well at all.
No, they have not. And I have two girls and two boys. If my son goes over to a girl's house to pick her up for a date, and the dad has a gun, that dad and I are gonna have a conversation.
Or at least maybe if he has it out when he answers the door.
Well, yeah, if it's out when he answers the door, then I hopefully my son will turn around and say, "All right, well,
your daughter's very nice, but you're crazy."
Yeah, yeah. You're a jackass. I'm not gonna. it might run in the family.
Yeah, I remember when I saw that on Twitter, I was like, I know exactly what he's doing, and I forget who was that NFL guy. I forget.
Yeah,
his name.
Like a kicker, like a football NFL kicker.
Yeah, I don't keep up with NFL sports, so I forget his name.
Yeah.
But it also brings me to another quick thing before I saw you tweeted out today that your son, was it your oldest son that had an active shooter drill?
No, it's my 6-year-old in kindergarten.
Your 6-year-old?
He had a lock-in drill, yeah. So, yeah. So, this has been something that has been, kind of edgy about, kind of frustrated by. He's had them before. I've written about them a few times in my blog about how my feelings on.
I mean, we had lock-in drills when I was in school, because we also had bomb threats made to my school when I was there.
Oh,
they were never real. It was just some guy trying to get out of a test. No joke. No joke.
Wow.
But no one took anything seriously. We would have, like, oh, we're having an active shooter drill, and they literally would just sit there. They wouldn't even lock the doors. No one ever came by. It was just like 5 minutes later, they would come over the intercom, the drill's over.
Yeah.
So, but now where they're actually doing things.
Yeah, now, like, I mean, schools all over, they have these drills now where there's a whole lot more rules and a whole another level of seriousness to it than there was, you know, years ago. So that, he had to his kindergarten class day. There's an alarm that goes off in the school, And then they either hide in their cubby holes where they hang their jackets, or they hide into a closet. And this time they hid in a closet, and all the kids had to get on the floor. Now, he's 6 years old. He's in kindergarten. So it's a teacher and like 17 kindergartners with their, you know,
how big is this closet?
With their hands over their head. And so my son, he was in the corner, and all the kids were sort of, you know, they take it very seriously. So all the kids are pushing in there, and his head just getting rammed against the wall today by everyone just pushing in, going through this drill. And again, it's like, you have to be quiet. You can't talk because this is a drill. You don't make any noise. I know you're upset, but we can't be talking right now. And it's,
that is so sad.
Yeah. This is a world that, you know, we live in now, that we have, that kids have to go through lock-in drills like this.
Oh, I could only imagine. Just to add that onto a list of things to worry about raising kids into this. You already got enough to worry about. Add in active shooters at school. And it seems like there's just trouble and danger everywhere you go.
It is. But you know what? Like, I was telling someone the other day, it seems that there's trouble and danger everywhere I go. And I'm very frustrated that we live in a world where we have to have active shooters. But I'm really excited about what teenagers are doing right now and speaking out and finding their voice. And so I think that raising a teenager during this time where really, like, they have, so many teenagers have, you know, a mouthpiece now and have a voice and are amplifying their voices to wanting to change the world. I think it's an exciting time to be a parent, to be able to participate in raising kids during this time.
Yeah, I almost put it back to the protests like in the 60s, and you know, those were young people protesting, and somehow by the time my generation was born, no one protested anything.
Yeah.
Adults would just say things and you went, okay.
Right.
Whatever.
Yeah. Whatever it was just accepted then.
All right. The Jason Green. And then one quick thing before you go. So I kind of allude to the beginning that I think that raising children in NYC is just a daunting task. You've proven me wrong. Kara Markowitz has proven me wrong, because I think she has three or two. Who knows? But if someone is in a committed in a point in their life where they're thinking about having kids and they live in New York City, would you advise it?
Oh, absolutely. I think I actually think this is the greatest city in the world to raise kids.
All right. Well, Jason Green, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast this week. If you want to check out his blog, you can go to onegooddad.com. And if people want to check you out on Twitter, what's your Twitter handle?
My Twitter is, what is my Twitter? It's the Jason Green. There's an E on Green. The Jason Green.
I like it. Jason Green, thanks so much.